This gives you an example of the type of puzzle that I really respect. And I might start out, and you guys might have a number one painted on your bib. Okay, so you're up at the front of the gymnasium and you've got a number one. And I invite up two grade two kids and I put a number two on them. And then I said, let's try to organize ourselves in a line. So that
how can we engage our students for the entire class with grade level content? Puzzles aligned to grade level standards is actually one answer. And in this episode, we speak with Gordon Hamilton from MathPickle.com, who designs mathematical puzzles for K to 12 classrooms. So stick with us and you'll learn how to use puzzles to teach grade level standards, how to challenge students who tend to move through problems faster than others, and how to manage the overflow, and how and why games are important for mathematical thinking. Let's go!
Welcome to the Making Math Moments That Matter podcast. I'm Kyle Pierce.
And I'm John Orr. We are from MakeMathMoments.com.
This is the only podcast that coaches you through a six-step plan to grow your mathematics program, whether it's at the classroom level or at the district level.
And we do that by helping you cultivate and foster your mathematics program like strong, healthy, and balanced trees. So if you master the six parts of an effective mathematics program, the impact that you're going to have on your teachers, your students will grow and reach far and wide.
Every week, you'll get the insight you need to stop feeling overwhelmed, gain back your confidence, and get back to enjoying the planning and facilitating of your mathematics program for the students or the educators that you serve. Hey, hey there, Gordon. Welcome to the Making Math Moments That Matter podcast. I can't remember when it was the last time that you and I were on a Zoom call. It was quite a while ago. I know you recently connected with John on another call, and we are just so excited to finally have an opportunity to have you on the podcast so folks can learn a little bit more about what you are doing over at Math Pickle. But before we dig in, Gordon, how are you doing, my friend? Where are you coming to us from? And tell folks just a teeny bit about your shtick here in mathematics.
I'm coming from Calgary in Canada, just like you guys. And Siri very helpfully told me today it was started out at minus 15, 0% chance of rain. So that was my day.
Right. I love that. That's quite chilly. John, I feel like we were above zero again today, I think.
We've been above zero for weeks.
Side note, last night, John and I did a webinar for
Idaho.
And we are actually more south than they were in Idaho, which it blew their minds. We had to like bring up the map. So you're in Canada. You're at minus 15. No precipitation. We're in Canada.
No rain. That's what was introduced to me. No rain.
No rain.
15, and that's what my phone told me this morning.
Oh, got it. Got it. I see what's happening. But there could be icicles coming from the sky. So look out. Yeah, I totally missed it. But we are definitely quite a bit further south than the folks in Calgary. But hey, my friend, let's keep rolling along. Tell us a little bit about you. What do you have going on in the math space? We know about you, but let's make sure the Math Moments community knows a bit about you. What's your role? What are you up to in mathematics?
So I got my PhD in mathematics and was going along, enjoying myself. And then my wife got pregnant and I thought, I'm going to volunteer at a math fair to see what education has in store for my son. This was 18 years ago. And I walked into this math fair and these kids had been working for 2 weeks on their puzzle. I walked around, I solved one puzzle, solved another puzzle, then stood in front of this grade five girl and she showed me her puzzle. And I looked at, oh, how do I solve this? And she knew that I was a mathematician. And I was just going, oh, no. And the more that I struggled, the more this little evil grin went across her face. And I never solved it there. I solved it there. But I left there with midlife euphoria. I just thought, oh, my gosh, I can take my board game design skills and throw them into designing puzzles for the math classroom. And I know this is going to work and it's going to be wonderful.
Awesome. That was how you got into your current kind of role right now, working with puzzles, working at Math Pickle. Is that the case?
That's right. So I don't have any background in education, but I hit the ground running because my mentor was Richard Guy. He was the oldest practicing mathematician at 103 years old whenever he died a couple of years ago. He was my mentor, and his book, Unsolved Problems in Number Theory. Oh my gosh, I just love that book. So I just hit the ground with very poor pedagogy, probably, but going into classrooms and introducing kids to unsolved problems and saying, okay, let's struggle with this together. And of course, right away, you realize you don't want to be doing that and then just laughing at them. You want to be coming up with vignettes of success along the way to them discovering these beautiful gems of mathematics.
Wow. That is awesome. And you saying that and giving me this glimpse into sort of a bit of your past and how you've gotten into this world really gets me excited for the question that we ask every guest that comes on this podcast. And it's about your math moment. I'm so curious, with someone who is, I love how you described it as your midlife euphoria. You had this euphoric moment by going to that fair. And you had obviously had a love for mathematics, had your PhD in mathematics. So when you go back and you think about the math moment that you remember from your, we call it kind of like childhood, but really it's through your education, through K through 12, something that pops into your mind when we say mathematics or math class. What is it for you? Because I know that there's so many people out there that have varied memories. And for some, it's actually hard memories and maybe moments that aren't so pleasant. I'm really curious about yours. I'm curious to see where you go. Was it a positive one? Was it one that maybe taught you something? What's the math moment that sticks out to you?
Age three, I was introduced to mazes in Northern Ireland. That's where I'm from. By grade five, I'm in Canada and I'm failing school. There's 60 students in my class. There's three teachers. It's a university school in Calgary. And I'm taken out with two other boys and put in this slow learners group. And I hated school. And I went home and I would be designing these elaborate three-dimensional marble mazes. So I end up repeating grade five. My mother took me out of that school, put me in another school. So I'm very careful about children and looking at them and really trying to celebrate slow, methodical problem solvers. I want to protect them. I don't have hands raised in my class ever. Whenever I'm going around, I ask every kid for giving something to the puzzle that we're doing on the whiteboard. And hands are never raised, but those kids are contributing. So that becomes their puzzle.
Right, right. Now, I'm going to dig here a little bit, Gordon. Like, I'm curious about that experience that you just shared, thinking like in grade five, you repeated, you went to a different school, but then what was different? What was at one school, but then different in the other school? And I'm very curious, you became a mathematician and having to repeat the fifth grade. So that is a very interesting story, because you don't hear of like, I'm a mathematician and I had to repeat the fifth grade. So fill us in on the details, because I think all the listeners right now are like, wait a minute.
Yeah, nobody was betting that was coming. You know what I mean?
So what was the difference between those two fifth grade years? Or was there some moment that kind of changed for you?
It was coming over from Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland was a very structured system. And then I was put into this very loose system where kids were encouraged to learn by themselves and at their own pace. And I was just totally lost. So I got back into a structured school, was an average student till grade nine. And then Jim McConnell, who runs Stratford Hall in Vancouver, he was my science teacher. And I can remember the lesson where he's describing the Bohr model of the atom. And every day we have to do a scientific experiment. And I had to write up a hypothesis about cuprous and cupric oxide. And I just hypothesized that cuprous oxide was the touching of two circles at a point, and cuprous oxide was touching at two points. Anyway, it was totally wrong. He just marked it, oh, what an interesting idea. And he marked it like a really high mark, which he hadn't done before. I was thrilled. So that was me becoming a scientist first before I'm a mathematician.
Right, right.
So now you're getting into classrooms. Now you've taken this experience to say, I'm conscious of the slow, methodical thinker. That brings up the slow part of my brain, fast part of my brain, and thinking about making sure that we honor those thinkers that take time to kind of postulate, think in our classrooms, when I think so much of our classrooms, and when you think about math classrooms, like you said, no hand raising. And it's like, I think so many classrooms, the teachers are very quick to be like, here's a question, who's the fastest to answer, instead of thinking like, we need that methodical portion of our class. So now you're in classrooms these 18 years working with students on puzzles. Paint us a picture. Like, what does that look like when you're going in? What are some of the benefits you're seeing with students engaging in the puzzles you're working with in those classrooms? And then, like I said, paint us a picture of like what a puzzle might look like when you're working in those classrooms.
Hey, Math Moment Makers, Kyle here. And I've got just a quick message specifically for our district level mathematics decision makers out there. Do you feel like you're spinning your wheels when making district level goals for mathematics programming from kindergarten through grade 12? Setting new goals each year only to find little to no real shift in pedagogical practice or educator content knowledge across the district as a whole? Take a moment to book a short call with our team so we can learn more about your specific district and educator learning needs in mathematics so we can assist you in taking the first step of many in the right direction. Visit makemathmoments.com/district to book a web call with our team today. We have a limited number of spots for districts just like yours, so don't wait. Head to makemathmoments.com/district and grab a spot in our calendar now.
So an example of a puzzle, this one's not mine, but it's one that I did in Collingwood School in Vancouver to the whole assembly of the school. So this is like hundreds of kids, multi-age group. This gives you an example of the type of puzzle that I really respect. And I might start out and you guys might have a number one painted on your bib. Okay, so you're up at the front of the gymnasium and you've got a number one. And I invite up two grade two kids and I put a number two on them. And then I said, let's try to organize ourselves in a line so that between those of you who have ones, there's a single person. And between those of you who have twos, there's two people. Okay, well, if you go 2, 1, 1, 2, well, then the twos are happy, but the ones have got no one in between them. So that's not good. 1, 2, 1, 2. Well, then the ones are happy because there's just a single person in between them, but the twos are not happy. Okay. Let's get up some grade threes. So the grade threes come up and is this going to work with grade threes? So let's see. Then we have all of the kids are the kids at the front. It's difficult for them to think. Okay. So I don't just expect them to think. I just want them to get in a line. Okay. Just forget thinking, just get in a line. And of course they're going to mess up. But I love to teach through failure. So I want them to mess up, right? This is more interesting for the audience, for them to say, oh, you've got three people between the grade three kids. You've got two people between the grade two kids, but you don't have one person between the grade one kids. Ah, failure. So I celebrate failure all the time. In kindergarten, I call it failure, but we celebrate it with a light heart. And let's give some examples of okay, so one example of a failure is this puzzle with bubbling cauldrons. This is an unsolved problem from 1917. It was a Jewish mathematician working in Berlin, ended up having a pretty tragic life, escaping to Palestine, where he died in poverty on his 66th birthday. So I'd like to honor this man. I say sure. So anyway, back to this beautiful puzzle. I have it bubbling cauldrons. Okay, and I have two bubbling cauldrons, and we are going to put in a lizard into one cauldron. Okay, number one lizard. There we go. Boop. Okay, John, you're holding one of these. Kyle, you're holding the other pot. So there you go.
People are going to have to see this on YouTube now.
Yeah.
My pot's better than yours, John.
Yeah,
my cauldron.
Okay, John has lizard number one in his pot. Lizard number two, Kyle, where would you like it to go? In John's pot or yours?
Oh, I want a lizard myself. So I like number two.
Two. Okay. You've got number two. John, where do you want lizard number three? Do you want to give it to Kyle or do you want to keep it yourself selfishly?
I don't really want the lizards. So, Kyle, you take this lizard.
You're not a lizard fan?
There's two and three are in Kyle's pot. And John,
I got one.
Number one. Number four. Okay, where are you going to put number four, Kyle?
Take them. I don't want it.
I didn't miss whether lizards are good or bad, did I?
Yeah, we're not sure of the goal here.
Okay. We're just playing. This is good.
Never introduce the rules of the puzzle.
Yes, I love it. I'm going to keep them. I'm going to keep them. I love it.
Two, three, and four.
Yeah. John, three and four.
You've only got one.
I got one.
Number five.
I get to pick?
You're going to give it away, right?
I'm totally giving it away.
Okay.
Take this
unfortunately, for Kyle.
Oh, there's no rule.
Two. Plus three. You've got two, three, and four in your pot, Kyle.
Yeah.
Yep.
Two plus three is equal to five. Whenever that lizard drops in, ba-boom, you get gooped because two plus three is equal to five. The lizard that you are dropping in is equal to the sum of two lizards that you already have in your pot.
And what happens?
He gets gooped.
And then boom.
Now, that's failure. But what grade two kid doesn't want to be gooped?
Kyle. Yeah. Totally. The cauldron
we're done. Yeah. So you're saying we can't put it in there or the game's over?
Oh, you put it in there, it explodes back to zero. Okay,
we start it again.
It's also important that we do not just try to finesse it and say, okay, let's take it out again. No, the whole dynamic of the classroom, you want to have an epic fail. The thing explodes, you're right back to square one. Okay, you got up to five. Can you guys get up to six? Can you get up to seven?
I love it. And we both want to get as high as we can, right? So we're kind of like collaboratively here. It's not me trying to boop or goop or dupe John.
You don't want to do that.
And we're taking turns choosing. We're a team. We're a team.
You're a team. You're a team now. So I'm not sending off the kids. They're into pairs. They're off in their own desks.
Let's figure this out.
They're trying to get up to eight. I do tell them that eight is the objective here. Grade two classrooms. Some of those kids will get up to eight in 5 minutes. Some will take 20 minutes. How do you deal with that? So this is a typical example of what I call an infinite pickle puzzle. Ones that just keep on going. You just add a pot. How high can you get with three pots? So you want to shut down those kids as soon as you get that celebration. Hey, we solved it. We solved it. We solved it. Okay. You do not want everyone around to be demotivated. So you send those kids off. You work on three pots. You send another group off. Oh, you guys work with odd numbers. Okay. Just stay with two pots. You guys work with odd numbers. Next group, you guys work with even numbers. How high can you get? Okay. So
I love that.
You're all the time kind of cutting against the assessment that you have of student ability. I don't want my top kids to be ego basking in front of the whole class. I want to shut that down.
It reminds me of, we always get asked that question, Gord. So it's like when we talk with teachers here on the podcast, it's one very common question is when I'm, you know, engaging my students in problem solving at the boards or wherever or whatever they're working on. It's like some groups are done early, some groups not. How do I challenge the ones that are done early? We've always said you got to have this kind of arsenal of extensions, or we call them like these little things in our back pocket. We take out and keep the challenge going, keep that thinking going, keep them in flow. And your idea of let's just add another pot. It's like, what are those? We have to have those in our back pocket every time we have a problem like that, right? It's like, what are those next step things to keep the thinking going, but also raise the bar, raise the challenge a little bit. And what I love about your problem is that not everybody has to get to adding the extra pot. That's not the goal. The goal is to just keep thinking going. It's not like, hey, we got to make sure everyone gets to the three pots or even numbers.
And then once you do, you get to stop. No, it's we're going to keep going. We're going to keep thinking.
So top problem solvers, top kids in your class, they're always deflected into problem solving. Never a waste of time. The kids at the bottom who are working on skill acquisition, you can go around and you can help individually with skill acquisition. But your top kids are engaged because this is an interesting problem. If we go back to the other problem where you have kids now in grades one, two, and three. Okay, let's just say that now we're in grade three. This is, you've got 25 kids and you have got some kids who have solved three. You guys can figure out three, you can solve. You can, so you've got two threes, two twos, and two ones, and you can figure out a way to match those. And then you might have really great kids, smart kids coming up and solving it. And then you shut them down with, okay, you try it for six different students. And then a slow group later on, you actually tell them, so that the other group can hear. You guys be the first in the class to work on 7, okay? So all the time trying to muddy the water. So you give those, the kids that are not used to getting the higher level activity, you give them publicly, in a subtle kind of way, you give them publicly an even tougher looking activity. In this case, it's not that much tougher. But in fact, I think 6 is impossible to solve and 7 isn't. So there's clever little things that you can do pedagogically.
People, if you're listening right now, friends, you have to go on YouTube because the look on your face, Gordon, you were talking about the kids having the mischievous little grin there at that math festival that you were at. But you've got the same one, which I love. Yeah, I love that about this right now. I'm so happy we have video on.
I'm completely reminded of when you said, like, you got to be clever. You got to have these little kind of nudges and kind of like to stick it to them almost sometimes to keep that engagement going. It often reminds me of Nat Banting, Kyle, from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. He's got a teaching move that he's always like, oops, I forgot. He's kind of saying, like, he gives the instructions out, but he didn't give them all out. And then all of a sudden, like, they're working around. And then he's like, you know what? The kids solve a problem. It's like, oh, I forgot. It's supposed to be an even number you have to use. And then they're like, ah. And then everyone's back to the drawing board, right? And then they'll do it again. He's like, oh, wait a minute. And then they're all like, oh, come on, Mr. Banting. I've used that in my class. It is gold.
Yeah. Love that.
I love it. I love it. This is fantastic. So you, the thing we were talking before we hit record, and we were talking about there's so many similarities of some of the things we talk about. There's likely a lot of differences as well, right, in terms of the approaches. But I definitely love that similarity there where although you're using, we'll call it maybe not in all cases with not all puzzles, but I'm sure that many of these puzzles are maybe considered non-curricular puzzles because it may not directly connect to, say, the curriculum that they're working on.
I'm quite specific with curriculum. I really try to link it up. So very rarely do I introduce a puzzle that is non-curricular. There's no need. There's such a wealth of beautiful puzzles. There's no need to go for non-curricular. So listening through some of the old podcasts, I have Peter Lilijal say, rich tasks are non-curricular. And I just don't get that. I don't understand. For me, there's no reason that rich tasks cannot be non-curricular. I don't have an introductory task and then the main task and then a wrap-up. I have one task. And if I was to say one thing for if I'm going to be teaching some pre-service teachers coming up, and I'm just going to be throwing them into a classroom unprepared. I don't want them to know the answers. I don't want them to be birds teaching bats how to fly. I want them to go in and solve it with the kids. And I don't want them, if the kids are engaged, I don't want them wrapping up that lesson with a nice little bow tie. If the kids are engaged, there is nothing that you can say as an educator that is useful for a vast majority of those students. Yes, you might hit 20%, 30%. Do not interrupt your class. Go right to the buzzer. So very different what I'm teaching whenever I'm in Alberta, very different from what I see many of your other educators teaching.
Hmm. This is really interesting. And you had mentioned about the whole tying it up, right? And I think that's a really interesting one because when there is really great thinking going on, I think I agree, you know, and John, I'd be curious to kind of hear your thinking as well. And this is where I think it gets tricky for educators because sometimes they hear one thing and then they think it's all in on that one thing. So for example, never maybe consolidating, but what I think I heard you say, and maybe you can reiterate this or confirm or deny this, is like if students are still engaged in the actual thinking and the actual learning that's going on and they're engaged in that, that we don't want to sort of cut that short in order to wrap it up. Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying that?
Exactly. I would use that as a technique if I see that the class needs a breather. I would use what you would call consolidation at any time during the lesson to say, okay, I see that now I've got down to 80% engagement. Not good. I want to get the class just a breather and then back in.
I love it. Yeah, very awesome. And I'm curious, so with some of these tasks that are, you said, vast majority are curricular, John and I also have always sort of advocated for the idea of, especially at the beginning of a school year, sometimes some educators think of bringing in different tasks that are non-curricular because it's easy to get students into. But John and I have always sort of felt differently about that. We've always felt that we can use mathematics to engage students so that they're actually learning mathematics, right? Math that's going to assist them throughout this year and beyond. So we've always kind of advocated for that. For you, if you're in a classroom and let's say, and let's pretend that you're not just dropping into a classroom, like let's say it's your math classroom, what in your mind does it look like to help students sort of, when we say consolidate, when we say almost like tying the loose ends to make sure that they sort of got what they got out of the problem? So what I mean by that is sometimes we solve problems, but we're not necessarily sure of what that means or how I might apply it somewhere else. So what might that look like to Gordon?
Okay, so I am talking about elementary school. I am skeptical about, I think that there's a problem between assessing and getting the classroom culture that you guys want. These two things look to me like they are in conflict. I would much rather in elementary school be assessing for the standards for mathematical practice rather than anything else. So if I see a kid really try to work, yeah, that's great. That's what I think I would want to be assessing, not skill acquisition.
Yeah, I think we're in complete agreement with that for sure. We often say that we would love for the refocus of what's happening in our classrooms across North America and I guess the world is to say that I would love the focus to be the math practice standards, and the vehicle to get there is the curriculum or the content standards. We should be using that as a way to unfold the math practices instead of the other way around. Most teachers are like, we got to get the content in, focus this content, and these other things kind of trickle in. If I structure my lesson right, I'll get those things in instead of going, the point is to get those things in, and we're going to use the content to help us get there. I think that has been a big push that we've had with the districts that we work with and also the classrooms we've been teaching in.
Gordon, I'm wondering, you know, with the work that you're doing, what does that look like and sound like? We have some educators who have visualized, some of them have visualized John and I holding cauldrons. Some of them are visualizing students in front of the gym. And what I'm getting is they're probably picturing in their minds, they're like, wow, I wish I was better at doing stuff like that. So my wonder is for those teachers who are listening going, I wish that I had a little bit more of what Gordon's got going on. What would you say would be a good first step for them? How can they maybe take a step in that direction if maybe they haven't felt that they've maybe they're just unsure? How do I begin this journey?
Hey there, Math Moment Makers. Are you a dedicated listener? Like, I'm talking, have you been listening for a couple months, maybe even a couple years? Well, if you haven't taken a moment to leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform, it would mean so much to us. It'll take you under 1 minute so that you can help more educators see and experience the Making Math Moments That Matter podcast. Do us this huge solid. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And here is today's episode.
Yeah, so I would take a beautiful unsolved problem. One of my favorite ones is from 1967. It's called the Graceful Tree Conjecture. I call it animal subtraction on mathpickle.com. And just take that, understand how it works. Very simple rules. You want to have minimal words in a math classroom. All of these things that have got this much text. I don't get it. This is not aesthetically pleasing mathematics to me. I want to have a minimal set of rules that opens up a universe of interesting possibilities. This is an unsolved problem since 1967, but the kids can solve. I'll just describe it. You've got five circles, okay? They're connected in a row, and you're going to put odd consecutive integers into those circles. So go ahead. Maybe your first attempt is 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, okay? Just in a row. Well, you fail. Okay, because you're trying to get the differences between those neighboring circles. You're trying to get those differences different. So 1 and 3, the difference between those is 2. 3 and 5, the difference is also 2. Okay, you've already failed. So that's the question. How do you do that? But then you can reorganize those 5 circles. You could, for example, have 2 circles touching or 3 circles touching 1 circle. So you can do that. And then all the touching circles, the differences between those have to be different. It's easier to see this one in real life. But if you Google graceful tree conjecture, you'll see a number file video of me working with it. And that's a nice example. But that is an example of a puzzle that is pretty well guaranteed to keep your kids entertained and engaged for the entire class. So this problem about how to wrap up classes, I don't think it's going to happen a lot. If you go in and you don't have to prepare, I don't want you to know the answers, okay? Just relax the night before, go out and have a green tea and celebrate life with your friends. I don't want you knowing the answers. I want you to go in and yes, you feel vulnerable, okay? That vulnerability is working through that, I think, is the most wonderful, liberating experience for teachers. Because once you get through that and you're okay, what's the worst that's going to happen? The worst that can happen is you might think that one of your students outshines you. Okay, well, a big deal. Okay, that happens. Another embarrassment might be that you end up not being able to solve it as a class. But what does that mean? That means that all math classes become exciting then. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Are we going to completely blow up altogether and not end up with anything beautiful? Yeah, it makes math class interesting to go in with that rawness of, I don't know if this is going to work or not.
I love it. I'm excited. You've got me giddy over puzzles here, but I'm now trying to think, and I'm trying to think of the listener out there who's saying, I love this idea. I want to dig in. I want to learn more, but I'm wondering, and I'm 100% in alliance. It's almost like in a belief piece where I say, yes, that truly problem solving with your students side by side is such a magical opportunity, right? When we talk about math moments, like think of the moments that you can have. But then the other part of me, and this is maybe the devil's advocate kind of coming out saying, you know, Kyle, I've got this curriculum and I have to achieve, whether we like it or not, or whether it should be done that way or not. What would you say to those who are thinking like, how can I be intentional about, say, the teaching and what I'm trying to pull out? Now, I'm totally on board. I totally get the idea that, yes, we want the math practices there, process expectations, whatever you want to call them from whichever curriculum we're looking in. But when it comes to the actual, let's say, content that we are uncovering in a course, whether it's elementary or high school, how do we as educators sort of feel like the intentionality of the lesson is there, especially if maybe I'm not exactly sure, or do the teachers know what the intentionality is of the puzzle, but we're still going to solve it all together in the class on the fly?
That's right. So if you want to work on multiplication today, before you teach multiplication, because if you know that 20% of your kids already know multiplication before you begin. Okay, so you don't start out with something boring. You start out with a really interesting puzzle right away. Okay, the objective of math class is not to teach easy. It's to teach engaged. And that means you're going to be presenting a tougher puzzle than the kids would otherwise be expecting, just seeing multiplication for the first time. But it's an engaging puzzle for everyone. So Mondrian art puzzles is an example of a beautiful, there we go, there's one solution of Mondrian art puzzles. For those of you who are watching the video. So the objective for the kids who are learning multiplication is to learn, okay, I need to have all of these rectangles of different dimensions. Okay, I'm going to be covering a square. All of my rectangles must be a different dimension. So I can't have a 2x6 and a 3x4. Oh yeah, I can, because those are different dimensions, even though the area is the same. And then I'm going to score my beautiful piece of artwork that you're helping Mondrian to paint. I'm going to score it your largest area minus your smallest area. And you want that score to be as small as possible. Okay, so this is a really interesting and beautiful puzzle. Okay, those kids, you know that you're going to have 15, 20% of kids who are, they're not excited about math class, but they're excited about making a beautiful artifact. And with, for them, they can color it. If they've got a messy puzzle sheet, I have extras because it is never a waste of time for me to give them an extra puzzle sheet and for them to make something beautiful that they are proud of.
Yeah.
Always celebrating beauty. If I have, this kid has solved the best, like they've got a really low answer, but this kid is not as high achieving in mathematics, but they've got something beautiful. Oh, I'll hold up this one. Look at this. Oh, that's nice. Okay.
Yeah. What I'm hearing you say, I think throughout this recording in our talk is, again, what kind of going back to the intentionality can be and should be some of the time, because strand A in our document here in Ontario now is about the practice standard. So it's like we can make the intentionality specifically about engaging students in those practice standards instead of the content, and the content's coming along for the ride. So I completely agree with you on that. It's like, this is the point of the lesson, is to engage students in problem solving, engage students in reflection, engage students in conjecturing, engage students in reasoning. That right there is can be the intentionality of some of your lessons. And I think teachers get hung up on the, like, I need to have the intentionality on making sure that we understand the algorithm of two-digit by two-digit multiplication, or I need to make sure that we can add these two things consistently this way. Like, that, yes, we want to be doing some of that, but yes, we also want to be doing some of what you're talking about and focusing on those standards, because now here in Ontario, it is part of the curriculum in a more direct way than it used to be. It's not just front matter anymore. It's building right in. So your puzzles are at mathpickle.com. If you go there, there's videos that walk you through how to kind of think about that puzzle, get started in that puzzle, kind of like shows you a little bit of the rules a little bit when you kind of get in. Gordon, I think there are going to be a lot of people going over there and kind of checking things out. Give us a snapshot of grade level content. What can they expect? We have primarily teachers listening to this episode, so they're going over there. What are they looking for in a quick synopsis? And then as soon as you share that, give us what big kind of takeaway you want teachers to take away from our chat here today.
Okay, whenever they go over there, there's going to be two tabs. There's going to be puzzles and games. We haven't talked about games. So just let me quickly say that the number one message of teachers to parents in elementary school is that you should be doing no worksheets with your children at home. Your only job is to adopt a board game and to play a board game with your child, or to get the child playing with another child. And that is because our number one objective in elementary school mathematics classrooms, it is problem solving. It's not arithmetic. Arithmetic is number two. But number one, I want my kids to think. And there is no more joyous excuse to think than a good quality board game. Not all board games are created equal. So that's why I've got some of my picks on the game section. But this is an enormous, this can really help to have parents really get their kids into thinking in home. So very important message. On the puzzle side, you will see my wide range of puzzles. There's most of them are, I'm trying to create these, what I'm calling infinite pickles. These are the puzzles that you can dial up with a single sentence. So if you solve the Mondrian art puzzle, you think you've got a good answer for 5x5. Well, then you just tell the child, okay, go for 6x6. Go for 6x6. If you guys have solved 6x6, then try 8x8. And so it gives you such classroom management power to have a really good puzzle behind you. Because so many of these tasks that I look at on many, many different websites, I would describe them as low floor, low ceiling. In no way are they anything that I would see. For me, a high ceiling means I'm interested as a mathematician. I can take any of my grade one puzzles, and you'll see on there my book, The Infinite Pickle. I can take any of those puzzles and I can present them to a graduate level mathematics classroom. So they can be understood by grade one, grade two, grade three students, but they are really ceiling high. Forget ceiling. Let's say it's a starry sky out there. We don't need a ceiling. Okay. That's the kind of puzzle that is worthy of the math classroom. And that's, we should expect nothing less whenever we decide to do this type of puzzle. A Math Pickle is not a full curriculum. You go there to get gems of mathematics, not to get a full curriculum.
I love that. So it sounds like you've scratched that itch that some of these people may have as they're listening, going, where do I get started? They've got a wealth of resources and opportunities over at mathpickle.com. So friends, definitely head on over there. I love that idea. Why even have the ceiling? You know, it's a starry sky. What an awesome quote. That's maybe my big takeaway for this episode. But Gordon, if we flip it back to you, if there's just one thing that you hope that the Make Math Moments community, the math moment makers out there, are taking away from this particular conversation, what are you hoping that they leave here with?
Number one message to parents, get your parents playing board games in the home environment.
I love it.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Gordon. And we want to thank you for joining us here on the podcast. And we're going to put your website in our show notes page. Is there anywhere else folks can kind of, you know, reach out to you or ask you more questions, or where's the best spot to find you?
Yeah, gord@mathpickle.com is my email. And the website has everything else, including that.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gordon. It's been great to see you. Stay warm and don't bring the umbrella out. You won't need it, right?
Yeah, bonus. High fives for you guys. That was an incredible 2-week discovery of your podcast. I'm up to number 28 now, and I'm enjoying it so much.
That's so fantastic to hear. We love it.
I just want to say, Peter, I mentioned something that I didn't like about him, but boy, I really like what I hear there. So yeah, a wonderful.
Peter is a fantastic friend. I think you would get along with him really well. You guys would really hit it off. So hopefully we'll all get together at maybe a live conference at some point soon. I know we bump into Peter quite a bit. If you haven't been to some of the math conferences, I would recommend, Gordon, get proposals in there. I think your message is such a great one.
Being a puzzle designer, finances are not the strength of that endeavor. So I have not been good at getting to conferences, and
they're not cheap.
Yeah. So that's not coming up in the near future.
Well, hopefully what I'm hoping for is that some folks out there, we know that you're listening there, friends. There's lots of people that are conference organizers, including ourselves. The virtual summit next year, I think, sounds like a great opportunity for you to be speaking at our, what would it be, John, our 6th annual virtual summit. So take this as an official invite, Gordon. We would love to have you as a part of that this coming November in 2024. So let's stay in touch about that. And those who are running conferences, hey, gord@mathpickle.com. Guess what? If you can get him there, I'm sure he'd show up.
I'm sure he would.
Thanks, Gord. Take care.
Take care.
Okay, I hope you loved that interview with Gordon just as much as we did. And when we think about our math tree, you know, our math classroom tree, or even our district level planning tree, a lot of times, actually, Kyle and I get asked about questions about, like, what should we focus on first? Should I try to bump up my math pedagogical knowledge? Should I think about how to strengthen my roots of my tree? Should I think about how to strengthen my own content knowledge and the models and the strategies around the concepts I'm teaching before I start thinking about pedagogy? Some districts are asking us, what curriculum should I be choosing? Should I be choosing this curriculum if we're valuing these in our classroom? Should we be choosing this? How do we choose our curriculums? And this is a case where I think about Gordon's work. It's almost like we start at what you think is important at the time, but also go, hey, you know what? I have this resource in front of me. I want to use the filter of what I think is important using this, but now it might spark the next thing. So for example, Gordon's talking about puzzles, which is the leaves of our tree. These are the resources. These are the lessons. These are the things that we can grab and bring into our classroom. We call those the leaves of our tree. But once you start thinking about a leaf of a tree or a resource, sometimes that will dictate the next moves. If I grapple and I want to use this resource, what are the things that I need to strengthen around my tree so that I can effectively use this resource? Sometimes it's like I have to strengthen the roots of my tree. I actually have to dive into the mathematics behind this so I can understand it myself and the tools and the strategies to unpack it for my students. Sometimes using a resource, we have to strengthen our pedagogical moves, our branches of the tree. And that kind of leads down a pathway to kind of go down, see what moves should I be doing in the classroom? Do I need to kind of perfect a move? Do I need to try a move in the classroom so that I can unpack this resource or this puzzle, as Gordon has outlined here today, in the classroom? And what are some of the moves around that? So I like to kind of
think about those things as I grab different resources around the internet or I hear on podcasts like this one. What are some of those next steps? What are the ways that we use the things that we have at our fingertips to strengthen our classroom tree? I want you to consider that here today. Do we need to kind of, if you're going to use this, do you need to go down the pedagogical route, the branches route? Do we need to strengthen the roots route? That's your kind of thinking point here today. That's my big takeaway. So thanks for listening to the Making Math Moments That Matter podcast. This was episode 282. You can find the show notes over on makemathmoments.com/episode282. And hey, again, thanks for listening. And if you have not yet, say, rated or reviewed the show, go ahead and do that and hit the follow button so that you can get the new episode as they come out every single Monday morning. And we can be in your ears as on your way to work doing the dishes, or maybe you're doing some exercise right now and listening to us, but we can be there giving you tips, strategies, ideas around your math classroom and strengthening your classroom tree up along the way.
All right there, Math Moment Makers. Until next time, I'm Kyle Pierce.
And I'm John Orr.
High fives for us.
And a high five for you.
If you are a district leader of mathematics, a math coach, a math curriculum coordinator, a superintendent, and principal, getting teacher buy-in for effective math teaching practice is top of mind. And plans only go so far. You can make, you know, detailed plans and carefully designed goals with clear objectives and key results that are measurable. But that can feel like it all falls flat if we can't engage our teachers in the work. Working with teachers who do not want to change their teaching practices is one of the most frustrating and challenging parts of our job. How do I help teachers engage in effective teaching practices when they keep pushing us away? If you can't reach the tipping point in mass adoption of effective mathematics teaching strategies, then it's likely we won't see student improvement in mathematics. We have a free training an accompanying workbook for leaders of mathematics like you. The Make Math Moments team, myself, John, and Kyle, walk you through our four-stage process we use with district partners to create clear, measurable, sustainable PD action plans, but more specifically on how to also get teacher buy-in so that it drives student engagement. So step one, register for this free training, get your planning workbook, and then watch the training. Schedule some time on your calendar so you can watch it and go through the workbook. After completing that workbook, you're going to have a clear, measurable vision, action plan for mathematics to get more teacher buy-in, but also be able to hit your goals for the 2024-2025 school year. So head on over to makemathmoments.com/4stages to start this free training.